Welcome to The Roundup, a North Queensland-based podcast with regional content for regional clinicians. I'm Alyssa Hatherley, a GP and family planning clinician and head of JCU's clinical school here in Mackay. This collaborative podcasting project between North Queensland Regional Training Hubs, JCU, and our local regional hospital and health services will bring you a different regionally relevant podcast each fortnight. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands where we meet today, who were the original providers of healthcare in this region. In today's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Kayleen Gergenti, who is a rural generalist with a specialty in women's health, having trained in ONG, who enjoys some practice in private general practice and some public work in the Townsville region across at Magnetic Island, in Currumbin, all kinds of exciting places. Welcome, Kayleen.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
We really wanted to talk about contraception, and I know this is something you spend a lot of time working in and have a particular passion for. What led you to women's health in the first place, do you think?
Well, I think being a woman, it's always really important to be seeing someone that you have confidence in. They know what they're talking about and that they've seen some things and that they have some experience. And so I really wanted to be that person for the women that I was seeing. I've worked in a lot of rural areas, and I know sometimes there aren't many options for the practitioners that you see, but I just really wanted to be confident, comfortable, and experienced in women's health. So I've really sought out as much as I can to try to make that a possibility for patients.
You're right. We have so many more opportunities these days in terms of contraception prescribing. Should we talk through a case then? Because sometimes people don't recognize the breadth of contraception options that are available to young women today. For example, a young woman who's 23, who comes into the practice, who is asking for a repeat prescription of her contraceptive pill. What would be the sorts of things you'd talk to her about?
So, and that is a scenario that plays out so often, and you might not have met the woman before, and, you know, they often expect to just come in, get their script and be gone 5 minutes later, if that. But I think it's really important to make sure that it's the right option for that woman to be on. So I like to know a little bit about her. I like to know, is she in a relationship or not at the moment? Is she just solely using her pill for contraception, or was it perhaps commenced for other reasons? Was she having menstrual difficulties? Was she having issues with acne? I then want to make sure, obviously, that if I'm prescribing something, I'm not giving her a medication that could cause harm. And that's where those medical eligibility criteria can be really important to be aware about and to perhaps have looked at before. If this is a young woman who suffers from migraines with aura, then perhaps a combined contraceptive pill isn't the best option for her. And it might be important to talk about other things. And contraception isn't necessarily the be all and end all. You know, do we need to talk about sexually transmitted infections and how to prevent those? There are so many other things that come into it.
Right. So if she has no contraindications to the contraceptive pill, then mm-hmm. it might be something that you continue with.
Yep.
What if she did have migraine with aura, as you mentioned, and we look at the medical eligibility criteria and recognize that the combined oral contraceptive pill is contraindicated?
Yeah, so it's one of my most dreaded conversations, to be honest, because a lot of women are very attached to their pill. They might have used it for years and be really comfortable with it and happy with it and everything is going well. But, you know, it really doesn't sit well with me if I know that there are contraindications to women using it. And so, you know, I've had to have this difficult conversation a number of times over the years and just say, look, there's good evidence that this could be risky for you to be using. And there are so many other options out there that may still offer you the same benefits or even more. You know, I'm not comfortable necessarily prescribing you that, but can we try to talk about why and maybe work out something that might be better suited for you? And it's one of those difficult conversations to have.
And it's that aura that's so important with migraine, isn't it? We don't want to write off the combined oral contraceptive pill as an option without good reason.
That's right. And, you know, some women who have other types of headaches are definitely fine to keep using it. But that migraine with aura especially is something to really be on the lookout for.
So what other pill options would we have for this particular woman, Kayleen?
So if she's really happy with taking an oral contraceptive pill, then obviously you've got your progesterone-only options. So the traditional ones might have been Microlute or Micronor, one of those two options. These days, there's a new progesterone-only pill on the market as well by the name of Slynda. And I've been finding that it's quite useful for women. So it's the pill which has drospirenone in it. I've been using that a little bit more frequently these days as well.
What are some of the benefits of using that new drospirenone pill, Slynda?
I believe it has some anti-androgenic effects as well. Sometimes it might be helpful in terms of avoiding like fluid retention or weight issues. I believe that it can also help with acne issues and those sorts of things as well. So it might have some other spin-off benefits that might be attractive for women.
And of course, the 24 active pills and the 4 sugar pills means that the period or that withdrawal bleed is more predictable for women using the drospirenone pill rather than a levonorgestrel or norethisterone progesterone-only pill, right?
That's right. Exactly right. I think that's one of the main issues sometimes with mini pills is that you may get some unpredictable spotting here and there, which can be one of the reasons why women might not like it so much.
If she doesn't really like taking a pill every day, what else should we be talking to her about?
Again, I think at this point, it's really important to assess what are you wanting out of your contraceptive? Is it just solely contraception? In which case, the long-acting reversible contraceptives or LARCs are really important to talk to women about. You know, do they want it to be the most reliable option out there? In which case, things like Implanon and Mirena might be worth talking about. With about a 99.9% efficacy rate at preventing pregnancy, it's really hard to go past them in terms of preventing pregnancy, not to mention the fact that you're not needing to remember to take something every day. And so convenience can be really useful. The spin-off to that is that it might sometimes involve a medical procedure, which a lot of people might not be overly excited about. But I think if it's going to be something that works for you and it's something that you don't need to think about for 3 or 5 years, then again, that can be really attractive for young women.
Of course. And in the private sector, there would be a bit of an outlay financially to commence one of those LARCs, mightn't there be? But it's for an extended period of time, as you say, 3 to 5 years. So that might actually make it more cost effective in the long term.
Yeah, that's right. Obviously, the devices aren't overly expensive these days. If you've got a healthcare card, then they're going to be the same low price that you would pay for one of your pill packets. It's more, I guess, the procedural cost, depending on which GPs you see or clinics you see. And again, there may be some public options. They often have a bit of a wait time. So yeah, I guess the initial financial outlay of the consult and the procedure cost might be a bit of a concern to some people, but certainly over the course of 3 to 5 years, it's probably going to be able to work out as a more cost-effective option.
So, Kellyn, what would be the reasons for going with an Implanon or a Mirena, one over the other?
When I'm talking to women, I suppose I like to assess, have they tried other hormonal contraceptive methods before, and did they ever notice any particular hormonal side effects that they might have pinned down to the hormones themselves? A lot of times women might find mood issues or emotional issues can be a bit of a problem with contraceptives. And so I guess if you're talking to them about Implanon versus Mirena, you might talk about how there's quite a low circulating hormonal level with Mirena. So that might make that option a little bit more attractive for women. You might talk to them a little bit about bleeding. For girls or women who are having menorrhagia or abnormal bleeding, then Mirena can often offer quite good control of bleeding patterns. And if women don't stop having a period completely, then oftentimes their periods will at least become lighter. So that again can be another great option with the Mirena. Implanon, I suppose, I don't find to be quite as good as Mirena at controlling bleeding patterns, but can still be worth giving a try.
So for our hypothetical 23-year-old woman who's currently on the combined oral contraceptive pill,
yes,
would there be a reason not to start a Mirena if she has not had a pregnancy, for example? Would that be a deterrent?
Not for me. I know that some inserters might feel uncomfortable about the idea of putting in a Mirena in a nulliparous woman, but I do it regularly. And I often find that these young women are quite motivated when they've made that choice to try the Mirena. And I can't say that I have had any more difficulty inserting Mirenas in nulliparous women than I have in any other woman. And I find often it's really straightforward and they're quite well informed as well.
Oh, I would have to agree, Kayleen. I think that's been my experience as well. So for women who are keen, what would be a contraindication then to using the Myrina?
So I guess with any type of contraception, they always caution us about abnormal uterine bleeding. You know, has it been looked into? Are we satisfied that there's really nothing suspect going on that could be causing that? Women with a fibroid uterus can sometimes have difficulty with Myrinas. It may be worthwhile if there's anything unusual in the history, just maybe looking into that a little bit further. Otherwise, I guess there are very few contraindications to using the Myrina. Because it's working so locally, you don't really need to worry about medication interactions like you might do with some of the other contraceptive options. It's a really great option for a lot of different women for a lot of different reasons, even those women around the time of menopause. And I guess the one thing that I do often suggest is that we do an STI screen before we insert them. And then I kind of make that a bit of a routine practice regardless. And obviously excluding pregnancy is a massive thing whenever we're starting contraceptives. But other than, I guess, undiagnosed abnormal uterine bleeding or a particularly troublesome fibroid uterus, I don't think there are very many contraindications.
Fantastic. Would you use the Depo-Provera or Depo-Rallovera injectable contraceptive very often these days then, Kayleen?
Not really. There are still some women who like using Depo, but I suppose it doesn't tend to be, and maybe this is because of my practice, maybe because it's not one of the first things that I talk about or suggest to women. I find that it's been getting used less frequently. But, you know, there are some women who've been on it for some years and they're quite happy with it and they want to continue. But I guess, yeah, just because of the way I practice, it's not one of the ones I'll often talk about first.
What are some of the downsides then of using the Depo injection? Because it does seem like such an easy decision for young women to make. And then when you come in and you're having that conversation with them and present some of the potential downsides, it becomes a much less appealing option, right?
So I guess fertility is a big one. Depo-Provera is one of the main forms of contraception that may delay a woman's return to fertility. And so when I'm talking to a woman about Depo, I really make certain that they have no imminent pregnancy plans. And I often make the suggestion that if they're going to use that for their form of contraception, that they think about stopping it at least 18 months ahead. Because for some women, there really may be a delay in their return to periods and ovulation and all of that sort of stuff. So I guess that would be the biggie that I'd be counseling them about. Obviously, it's something that they need to have done every 12 weeks or thereabouts. And coming back to the doctors for that might become a bit of a hassle. The fact that they need to be keeping regular appointments up with doctors. And I suppose one of the other issues, I sometimes find that Depo may be more inclined to cause weight gain in women. And obviously, once it's in, we can't really take it out. So that's the other thing. If Myrina or Implanon are causing issues, we take it out. Whereas Depo, you're kind of stuck with it until it wears off in its own time.
Yeah, that's a great deterrent, isn't it, that you can't get it out if you do experience some nasty side effects. And you're right, that 12-weekly injection does come around really quickly and often takes women by surprise.
Correct.
There's also that chance of osteoporosis with prolonged use of Depo too, right?
Yeah, so they used to talk about that, especially in like adolescent girls. And I think they've looked into it further. And please correct me if you've had more recent reading that's changed that thought. I think it wasn't such a big issue as they originally thought. And they think that bone density kind of does return to baseline after a couple of years. But yeah, that's always something that lingers in the back of your mind as well.
Yeah, you don't want someone to miss out on reaching their peak bone density when there's another option in terms of contraception that would be just as effective or maybe even more useful for them.
Yeah.
So when we're thinking about our 23-year-old nulliparous woman who's been on the combined oral contraceptive pill, turns out she's having migraine with aura. So we've looked at a few other options, including an intrauterine contraceptive device, because even though she's nulliparous, you and I are both quite happy popping an IUD into her, as long as she's not going to pick up an STD, as you were saying. What about a copper IUD? Do you use those very often these days?
Not often. You do get the occasional woman who is so convinced that the Myrina is causing hormonal side effects. And you do certainly meet a small group of women who may notice hormonal issues with the Myrina or just, I guess, be hesitant to put any type of hormones into their bodies, quote unquote. And so they will often look more towards the copper IUDs. I guess when I'm counseling women about copper IUDs, we discuss the fact that potentially periods might become heavier or more painful. So it's not common, but as a matter of fact, recently I've had a woman who had had a Mirena put in postpartum, mustn't be liking it currently. So she's requested a script for a copper IUD, and I expect to see her in the near future to change that over.
The big drawback, I think, is that women don't realise that the copper IUDs aren't stocked routinely in a lot of pharmacies. We have to get them ordered in. But of course, that increase in the amount of blood loss that a woman has with that copper IUD might only be the first couple of months, mightn't it? Their period might settle down and be acceptable. And if it's not, then we could always swap it out for one containing a hormone.
Correct.
The outlay for those copper IUDs, though, is a little bit more, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe they're not on the PBS. And because I don't use it so frequently, I'm not exactly sure on the price. I'll have to ask my lady when she does come back. Yes, I do understand that they're more expensive.
Yeah, I think they can be in the order of $100 or so, which is a bit more than a Mirena or an Implanon, which you'd get for $30.
Yes.
For those women who are really trying to avoid hormonal contraceptives, as you mentioned, some women might find a copper IUD a great option. What other alternatives do we have?
Obviously condoms, and quite often when we're talking about sexually transmitted infection, we'll also throw in condoms as well, because our other hormonal contraceptive options probably aren't going to give us much or any protection against sexually transmitted infection. So condoms, diaphragms, I guess, don't tend to be used too much these days, but it's something that women who are quite informed might look into. Again, some women want to discuss the rhythm method or the Billings method, and I guess I counsel them about the fact that it's not perfect, but if you're really motivated, then, you know, having an awareness about that method is better, I suppose, than not using anything at all or having complete unawareness about when your most fertile times are. But I guess those would be the main non-hormonal options: condoms, diaphragms, and natural family planning methods.
Of course, with natural family planning, those really, as you say, motivated patients, they can go through training programs to make sure they've got as much information about using that as possible, which might work for them really well.
Yes.
In terms of a diaphragm, we used to measure women up to get a perfect fit diaphragm for them, but we don't do that anymore, do we?
No. And to be honest, I have to say that in my however many years of practice since graduating, I graduated in 2005, I have never once had a woman who has wished for a diaphragm. I've never had to provide them one or size them up, which I don't know how many times you've had to do it, but it's just so uncommon. I would really have to go away and research and look into that myself.
I think I've done three over 20 years, Kayleen. So there you go. But interestingly, I don't recall having seen any of those women come back to actually talk about how successful those diaphragms are.
As long as they didn't come back pregnant, I would take that as a good sign as well, I think.
Oh my gosh. Of course, these days you can buy the Kaya, C-A-Y-A diaphragm online.
Yes.
You can't even get it from your local pharmacy.
Oh, so people order it over the internet these days. There you go.
Yeah.
Might be why I don't do many consultations. It's all self-help and sort yourself out.
Which is fantastic, isn't it? We want to make contraception as accessible for women as possible, particularly for women in North Queensland, in rural and remote areas or in the islands. We don't want women to have to miss out on the best contraceptive of choice for them. One thing we haven't talked about, Kayleen, is the Kylena, the new slightly smaller hormone-containing IUD.
Yes.
Have you inserted a few of those?
I haven't. And I guess, to be honest, I suppose I would really need a patient who I felt the actual dose of the hormone was the biggest issue for, because I'm not sure about your practice when you're inserting them, but I need to insert a sound first anyway, which I believe is as big or the same size at least as a Mirena. So the drug reps are kind of marketing this as a smaller option, a more petite option, but the practicalities of insertion for me mean that the sound that I'm putting in first is probably bigger than the Kylena itself. So, you know, I'm not really seeing necessarily what the point is, but that's just my personal opinion. That is not anything based on evidence or education. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it certainly is much the same size as a Mirena. You're right. I suppose it's been useful for me in women for whom the dose in the Mirena has been too much for them to manage. You know, those women who might get recurrent ovarian cysts, for example, won't experience that with the Kylena, but they're still going to get a period with Kylena. They are going to miss out on that potential amenorrhea that the Mirena offers.
So, yeah, I haven't really used a lot of Kylenas yet, but there will be those women where it will be a decent option. I think the women who have tried Mirena and didn't like it will often then opt for a copper IUD if they're still thinking along the IUD lines. And I might have a little bit of a battle trying to talk them into trying a Kylena if they didn't like the Mirena. But yeah, but perhaps I need to mention that as a first option for those women with the ovarian cyst history that we're really concerned about.
Yeah, I do think it's a little bit less uncomfortable for those really young women. So yep. Girls who are 16, 17, 18, who are quite small in stature themselves, you know, those really petite framed yep. women who don't have a heavy period, who are looking for that long acting reversible contraceptive, then I might try the Kylena. But of course, we do see so many really young women who have a ridiculously heavy period who really yeah. need that menstrual management to be maximized, for whom the Mirena is actually going to provide the greatest benefit.
Yep.
We could always pop the Kylena in and then upgrade them down the track to a Mirena if they don't get good enough period control. What are your top tips then, Kayleen, for prescribers in terms of contraceptive options?
So I think number one is know your patient. What are they looking for? Is it just solely pregnancy prevention, or do they have those other issues with acne or menstrual difficulties or all of those other sorts of things? So know your patient, find out a little bit more about their life. What's going to be most convenient for them? What can they afford? Those considerations can be really important as well. Give them all of the options and let them make an informed choice. I often find the little handouts, the patient information handouts from the old family planning website, which is now called true.org.au, and we'll attach links below this podcast to the websites that I find useful. Helping women to make an informed decision is really important. If they feel like they've been part of that decision-making process and it's not that we've forced something upon them that they weren't really interested in using, I think there's much more success of women using it well and having confidence in that type of contraception. And I guess just keep communication lines open, encourage them to come back if they're having any issues. Sometimes you need to do a little bit of troubleshooting if women are having problems with breakthrough bleeding or any of those sorts of things. So just make sure that you've left those lines of communication open after you've had that consult and decided on your first option.
I think that's fantastic advice, Kayleen. I think there's nothing more difficult than the patient who comes in and says, I want the best contraceptive. What are you going to give me? I want the best one. And I say, there's no best.
What? I know, best there for is. What?
That's right. We need to find the contraception that's right for you. That's fantastic advice. Dr. Kayleen Gergenti from the Townsville region, thank you so much for talking about contraception today.
I could talk all day about it. Thank you very much for having me.
For more information about the Roundup or to share your feedback and ideas for future episodes, visit nqrth.edu.au/roundup-podcast or contact us at nqrth.mackay@jcu.edu.au. We also want to advise that the views and opinions presented in this podcast are those of the speaker only and do not represent the views and opinions of James Cook University, Northern Queensland Regional Training Hubs, or Queensland Health. The content supplied in this podcast is not intended as medical advice and is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Northern Queensland Regional Training Hubs is an initiative of the Australian Government's Integrated Rural Training Pipeline and is facilitated by James Cook University in partnership with public and private hospitals, Queensland Aboriginal and Islander Health Council, health services, Aboriginal community controlled health organisations, and general practice clinics.